Emperor Tales of the Frozen South by C.W.B. and read by Ghost of Nuggets Past. Chapter 20. Hui Hui. Group. Constellation. Summary. The Junior Council begins training. John and Sherlock contemplate the night skies and find an opportunity to visit their ice cave. Early March. The summer passes in a series of training sessions, practicums, and assorted group activities. There are so few emperors on Cassiopeia now, and they are reliant on each other for so much. They hunt and eat together and huddle together at night. They learn together and teach each other. Sherlock finds himself challenged in many new ways, and the time goes fast, but he never stops wishing for more time alone with John. Each morning begins with a group hunt and a shared breakfast. John is well enough now to swim, and it takes him no time at all to retrain his shoulder to its previous strength and flexibility. He lets Sherlock fuss over him for only a few more days, and then insists that they swim together as equals. Sherlock gives up his role of protector with great drama and reluctance, and it's not until John assures him that they will always watch for each other no matter what that he realizes that John is not asking him to stop caring, just to stop hovering. After breakfast, they adjourn to the training grounds. Here, the 8 junior pangs, as they've come to call themselves, join the 6 senior pangs, and they spend the morning learning the workings of the colony and the detailed history of their past. They learn the myths and legends that grew from the sky when the world below was still only an idea. They memorize important names and events that, when strung together, create the essential journey to where and who they are now. Sherlock loves this part of the day and works hard to store away all of the information in his ice palace so that it is easy to cross-reference, analyze, and retrieve. His very favorite lessons are about the constellations. He is fascinated by the dichotomy between these vastly distant pinpoints of light and the cultural foundations with which they are so reverently imbued. He and John spend long evenings under those same stars, going over the day's stories. Side to side, or with John leaning back against Sherlock, they look above and trace the constellations' lines and angles with their wings, and whisper the whys and hows of the legends. They discuss the theories of how Leo came to rule over the sea lions. Could it really be that Leo was once a four-legged feline, ruler of the Felidae family? And if so, where are these animals now, these tigers and lions and jaguars? What happened to Leo's legs and paws? Was it a curse or a blessing that turned him into a pinniped? Sherlock and John decide that maybe it was both. They are swept away by the romance of the legend. Leo, attempting to rescue one of his own, plunges from the heavens and into the sea. Unwilling to sacrifice the kitten clutched in his jaws, but unable to resurface with the extra weight, Leo begins to drown. Enter Delphinus, who saves the sinking lion and his young charge in exchange for one night with the mighty god. Leo agrees, but must transform himself into the shape of a compatible creature. The night is spent in passion, and Delphinus finds herself with child. Enchanted, Leo stays, and the first sea lions are born. What about Hydra, then? Why would she abandon her eels, leaving the sea-dwelling Anguilliformes for the foreign land-based Squamata? Is it true that she fell in love with the land-dwelling herdsman and forsook her aquatic family for her mortal lover's world? Or was she cast out of heaven after tempting the goddess Virgo with forbidden harvest fruit? Or are these two tales perhaps intertwined in some way? Sherlock wishes they had proof of these cold-blooded snakes, because without them, exile seems more likely than elopement. He says to John, not for the first time, "There is nothing like first-wing evidence." John, though, is content to let his imagination fill in the blanks. "Have you seen those ears when we're hunting, Sherpeng? Depraved, the whole lot of them. It wouldn't surprise me at all if she turned her back on them and went after something better. Cassiopeia herself has a story in the stars. Pavo tells them that if, in the deepest of the darkest days, they look as far north as they can from Podeba, they'll see the iceberg's mother, the seated queen, trying to embrace her child. She's visible only by the five bright stars outlining her arms. She lowers them as close to the horizon as she can, over the sea and her daughter, who waits alone through the long stretch of winter until the sun reappears. The seated queen rises then, when Cassiopeia is bathed in light, neither isolated nor alone. Is it true, then, that the seated queen lost her daughter as punishment for her own conceit? Or did she send Cassiopeia and her twin Andromeda into exile to save them from a half-brother's unwanted advances? And where is the twin Andromeda now? They whisper back and forth, captivated by the heroics and exploits of the gods, until John starts to fade into sleep. Inevitably, he wriggles and nudges until he is ensconced under Sherlock's wing, and the mysteries of the stars are put off for another night. In the afternoons, the group dives and hunts for lunch, and then they break apart to meet his apprentice and teacher, or in John's case, apprentices and teacher. Erebus does a good job of keeping Sherlock focused on the application of his mesoscale theories to establish hunting strategies, no matter how often Sherlock tries to steer the conversation back to the apologists, a topic about which he's been unsuccessful learning more. John loves his lessons with Cetus and works well with Malling and Stamford. Each day he shares with Sherlock the healing practices he's studied, and if possible, the reasons behind the use of particular materials. Sherlock is most interested in the science of what the healers do, although John stresses to him that sometimes there is as much comfort in an incantation or calling upon the appropriate god or goddess as there is in laying a carefully crafted poultice to a wound or applying the right movements to a disjointed wing. At the end of the day, they swim and eat again, then gather for a debriefing of the day's events. Each junior Peng tells the group one or two things they learned and asks questions of each other's experiences. Sherlock eats it all up, filing away everything, no matter how unimportant it may seem at the time. Lestra talks about the territories and habits of their predators, effective patrolling strategies, and managing outbreaks of colony violence, of which Sherlock has seen nothing but is very curious. Irina, the teaching apprentice, another of Sherlock's new acquaintances, shares ways to hold a group of hatchlings' attention while instructing them, how to organize a curriculum, and how to field and answer questions from an audience. Most interesting to Sherlock is how to answer a question as if you know the answer, when in fact you know nothing relevant whatsoever. Why would anyone attempt to speak upon a topic on which they are uninformed? Janine, another new addition to Sherlock's circle of known pangs, discusses the craft of original storytelling, including how to extract and use personal information from others to spin a tale. The point, she says, is to always make your audience feel involved and relevant to the story they're hearing. It bridges doubt, she says excitedly, and fosters loyalty. Anthea stays annoyingly quiet and shares nothing. The senior Pangs must have an understanding with Mycroft, because no one questions her, ever. Sherlock does not trust Anthea as far as he can throw her. John and Sherlock's visits to the ice cave are few and far between, snagged here and there when they're granted free time the late afternoons or early evenings. Even then, it's hard to sneak away, as everyone is so aware of the comings and goings of everyone else. They very much want to keep their hidden lair a secret. An opportunity comes one evening when the others have opted to use their free time diving. Sherlock claims to have a headache, and John volunteers to stay behind and watch over him. When the others have disappeared into the water, Sherlock and John slip away and begin their ascent up Cassiopeia's side. Once tucked away in the privacy of their hideaway, John checks over their treasure and fusses over a few pieces that the wind has shifted. Sherlock loves this side of John, meticulous and nest-proud. He hovers nearby, utterly charmed, as John mumbles under his breath about order and arrangement and aesthetically pleasing design. John is precious, and Sherlock's heart is full of sentiment. He waddles over to the ice window before he embarrasses himself with some outpouring of emotional verbosity. John joins him soon after, and they go through the ritual of reading the stories and their surroundings. The tales are abbreviated now, without the colony's masses to offer inspiration. The sea is calm, the sky devoid of blemish, the horizon far and flat and dull. Neither mind. They have more personal narratives to explore, and they turn to each other, eager to pick up where they last left off. The summer has left signs of maturity on both of them. John's gray fluff has given way to mottled black and white feathers, as has Sherlock's. Neither have achieved their adult height, but Sherlock is 2 sure wingtips taller than John now. Sherlock has seen his reflection in the water from time to time, and he knows that his body mirrors the changes he sees in John's. The bulk of their shape is shifting, from their hips to their chests. Their wings are elongating, which helps tremendously with balance and locomotion. They have longer, stronger tails, and longer bills, too. Most of their new height is in their torsos, but some of it is found in the stretch of their necks, too. Sherlock loves this change the most and indulges in it now. He leans forward and slides his cheek up and down the sleek side of John's neck. John trills a low sound of encouragement, so Sherlock does it again and again. Soon they are entangled, neck to neck, chest to chest. John's wings stroke Sherlock's sides, and Sherlock's flutter and caress over John's shoulders. So caught up are they in their growing ardor that they don't hear the arrival of an unexpected visitor. Not until she speaks.
"Well, isn't this cozy?"
They pull apart, but only John turns his head to see who has joined them. Sherlock already knows.
"Moringa."
Notes. Maori translations. Hui hui. Noun. Assembly, group, constellation. On the constellations. I've taken so many liberties with the constellations' mythologies, it's hard to unweave what is human and what is Peng. For example, another name for the constellation Cassiopeia is the Seated Queen. Because I named the iceberg after this constellation, I decided to go with the other name for her mother. From Wikipedia. Quote, Cassiopeia was the wife of Cepheus, king of Ethiopia, and mother of Princess Andromeda. Cepheus and Cassiopeia were placed next to each other among the stars, along with Andromeda. She was placed in the sky as a punishment for her boast that her daughter Andromeda was more beautiful than the Nereids, or, alternatively, that she herself was more beautiful than the sea nymphs. Unquote. I made up the bit about Cassiopeia being Andromeda's twin sister. Hydra, other than vaguely resembling one, has nothing to do with eels. I liked the idea of the snaky figure being tied to an aquatic version of Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden, so I turned Virgo into Eve and Hydra into Satan and called it a day. I can't apologize. These Pengs are entitled to their own mythology. I don't have a lot of Peng images for this chapter, but I do have this 29-second video which shows a little robot Peng infiltrating a chick huddle, after which all viewers immediately melt into puddles. The video is on YouTube and is called Cleverly Disguised Baby Penguin Robot Interacts with Emperor Penguin Colony, posted by IB Times UK. This November 4th, 2014 article says, quote, "The newest tool for biologists is the baby penguin robotic spy. It's pretty darn cute and so convincing that penguins essentially talk to it, as if it is a potential mate for their chicks," unquote. I've never seen a single thing that indicates that pengs choose potential mates for their chicks. Ever never. But, hey, I'm flexible.